Welcome to the Shadow Net. My name's Phil, aka Xeroth Maxima, Threat Level Alpha. We say bad words, but we got a guest to impress, so we'll take it easy. My extra special guest this week, 9 out of 10 slums casts agree with his takes on Shaper. It's Eric Keelback.
I was surprised that people were so positive about my fuck Shaper takes.
I guess people hate Shaper, sadly.
I mean, people do hate Shaper. I just feel like they've been bad for so long, and now they've been good for like a month, and everyone's just like, okay, we can go back to Shaper being bad again. Yeah, it's really funny.
Wholeheartedly disagree, but you know. My bonus guest today, you know him from, well, you just know him. It's Mr. Michael Boggs.
Hey, thank you guys for having me on.
Thanks so much for coming on. I feel like it's so interesting because of Nisei now. There's so many new people who play the game. But I'll have to say, Michael Boggs is one of the former lead designers for Netrunner.
For people who don't know about the Bogfather, can you give us a rundown?
Yeah, sure. So, my name is Michael Boggs. People sometimes call me the Bogfather. I worked at FFG from 2017 until just a couple months ago, 2022. When I first started FFG, I was the lead developer for Netrunner. That was from 2017 up until the middle or end of 2018. And then after that, I worked on a couple other games, predominantly Marvel Champions, up until my departure from FFG.
Nice. So for Netrunner, that's about Katara to R&R, is that right?
Yeah, when I came in, how was it? I think Red Sands had just wrapped up. I didn't touch Red Sands at all. It was off to the printers in China, and they were also in the process of wrapping up the revised core set. I had a very small amount of input there, but I didn't really do a whole lot with it. It was mostly Lucas Litzinger and Eric Dahlman were the two that were doing it at the time. But yeah, the Katara cycle had just started. I think it had went through its first iteration of playtesting. So I kind of came in, and Damon Stone, the developer before me, he had done a really good job of sort of setting everything up for me. So it was an easy transition. And, you know, I just came in and kind of worked on Katara. And then once that was almost completed, I did Reign and Reverie, and then the game was canceled. So that was pretty much it.
Reign and Reverie was like, I think the thing for Reign and Reverie is like, it wasn't all your designs, but like you designed that thing kind of from the ground up. I remember
Reign of Reverie. Yeah. So Reign of Reverie, it was originally Reign of Reverie was going to be another
Chilo cycle, right?
Yeah. It was going to be the Chilo cycle, and it was going to be another big box to kick off a new cycle. But then the game got canceled in the middle of its development, so we sort of had to scavenge what we could and just, you know, make a box out of half completed art and all that stuff.
So were you just like working at your desk one day, and then you just get like a sealed envelope that just says like Netrunner's dead? Like what was the discussion? Did they just send you an email? Did they like sit you down and like give you counseling?
Yeah, and so it actually wasn't too dissimilar from that. I was in the middle of a meeting. There was an art director and my good friend Crystal. We were working on the game together. There was really only three people on the game at the time. It was myself as the developer, Crystal as the art director, and then a person named Joe in graphic design. He helped with cropping the art and stuff. And it was just us. So Crystal and I would have meetings regularly, you know, to make sure that the game was going in whatever direction with the art and the theme and all that stuff. Sorry, I misspoke. I guess there were all the story development people. They didn't have a hand as much, but like Dan Clark and a few others, we would meet a lot less frequently. They were also technically on the game. But predominantly, it was myself and Crystal. And we were having a meeting for Reign and Reverie, doing one of the waves of art. And while we were in the middle of the meeting, we were almost about to wrap up. There's a knock on the door. And Andrew Navarro, the head of studio, pokes his head in. He's like, "Hey, do you guys have a minute? Can I come in?" And we were like, "Yeah, sure." So Andrew walks in, and so do like a ton of other executives. My manager at the time, Mercedes, Nate French, who's now like the head developer of all of FFG. Like a bunch of people, Chris Gerber, who's he has Andrew Navarro's position. He's the head of studio. It was like 4, 5, 6 people come in and they all sit down. And like, I had no idea. I was like, "Oh man, I did something wrong. I'm getting fired." I have no idea what's happening. And so, yeah, Andrew just laid it out. He's just like, "We tried to make a deal with Wizards of the Coast. It didn't quite work out. We just weren't able to, see eye to eye on the new contract, and so we got to cancel the game." And that was pretty much it. That was as much information as I got. And then he was like, "I know we're in the middle of developing this box. I still want to finish it." He's like, "But like, we can't commit any more resources to it than we have to. So like, just make the box with the resources that we have." Yeah. I was like, "Oh, okay."
Yeah.
So, and that was just kind of it. The rest of it was history. So I'm pretty happy with how the box turned out, all things considered. But
it's a great box.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
I feel like Andrew loved Netrunner. You know what I mean?
Oh, he did. Like, yeah. He absolutely loved Netrunner.
I remember there was an interview he gave, I think, a year or two later, when someone's like, "Would you ever like do a Netrunner reboot? Like do another version of Netrunner?" And he was basically like, "We think about it, but like it's hard when you painted the Mona Lisa to like do the Mona Lisa again."
Sure. Yeah.
Because I feel like that was kind of the thing about Netrunner at FFG was that like everyone kind of like everyone loved Netrunner at FFG, like no one disliked the game really. That was always my impression talking to staff members and stuff.
Yeah, I didn't personally know anyone who disliked it. I feel like even if it wasn't there was always one thing or another to appreciate. If you didn't love the mechanics, which I know some people at FFG didn't, they really like the theme. Or if you didn't like the theme, then you really like the mechanics. Yeah. But most people, I feel like, they enjoyed both of those things.
For sure. In terms of how you started working at FFG, I'm always kind of curious about this kind of stuff. Because game design and game development is such like a non-traditional sort of career path in the sense that like, it's not always clear how people get into these roles. So my understanding is before you worked at FFG, you lived in Korea.
Yeah.
So what was the sort of pathway between like Minneapolis is kind of in the middle of fucking nowhere compared to Korea. So like, how did we end up from Korea to, "Oh my God, I'm the, lead developer for Netrunner"?
So when I was in college, I originally started out studying animation, and for different reasons, it shifted into game design. So before I ever went to Korea, I already had a strong interest in game design. Got over to Korea. I originally came to Korea to travel and explore and to teach. But the whole time I was there, I was sort of just working on my own projects. Originally, I wanted to work in the video game industry. But I quickly realized after getting out of school that I didn't really have any skills to do that. So instead, I started working on board games and card games and stuff, just independent designs. And I mostly got into board games because there was a very robust group of foreigners in Korea at the time that would meet and play board games. And there was a group that actually got me into Netrunner at that time. And that was sort of I had always played Magic when I was younger, but that was sort of my first introduction to the greater board game world. And so through that, I started kind of designing and developing my own stuff. And I did that for a couple years. And then one day I just happened to see a post on FFG's website. I was wanting to go back to the United States. I'd been in Korea for about 5 years at that point, and I was looking for jobs, and I was hoping to get a job in the industry, and just happened upon the position, the opening at FFG, saying that they were looking for a card game developer. And so I sent in my resume, and on my resume, I listed out, here's the card games that I'm familiar with, the rule sets, all that type of stuff. And I had Netrunner at the top because at that time it was my most played game. And it just so happened that was the position they were hiring for. It was luck. Like, it really wasn't any sort of like skill or any sort of special talent that I had or anything like that. Like, honestly, it came down to lucky timing. It came down to a lucky resume. It was actually a really dorky resume when I look at it now, because it had like on the side, it was like my top five games that I, you know and can talk about. And I had them like listed from like, it was like out of 10. So like Netrunner was 10 out of 10. And then whatever else was an 8 out of 10. And it was like, yeah. And they were just like, okay, yeah, this guy knows Netrunner. So I had some good interviews. And actually later I learned, you know, I talked with Nate French. This was like a year and a half, 2 years after I'd been hired. And I was just kind of chatting with him one day, and I was like, you know, I've never quite known why I was hired. I was like, was it because of my independent design stuff, all the work that I had done there? And he was like, oh, no, not at all. We just like talking to you. I was like, oh, okay. So all that year, all the years of hard work and struggle and stuff didn't even matter. It was just, you know, a good, good resume, rapport. Good timing. Yeah, yeah. And just a good conversation. So was I feel like any... if I can get into the industry, anyone can.
Was there any skill testing questions in the interview? Like how many credits does it take to break a toll booth with a Demara?
Yeah. It was, so the interview, there were sort of two rounds of interviews from what I remember. The first one was a very general, like HR type thing. And I think it was like a written something. It wasn't that hard. And then I moved on to the second round. And that one was specifically with Nate French, Chris Gerber, and Damon Stone. And so for that, to get to that interview, they sent like this, it was like all of these like prompts. It was kind of like a test. And okay. It was like, you know, design. It wasn't specifically about any specific rules or anything like that. It was more just to sort of test your design chops. So the first part of it was you had to write a vision document for like a new wave or a new cycle.
Sure.
And they gave you like a brief example of what it looked like, and then you just kind of did your own. And then the second part of it was to design, I think it was like 5 cards for different factions and talk about why you were implementing the mechanics that you were. And then during the actual interview, those two things, the vision document and the design cards, those were sort of the topics of discussion.
Yeah.
It was really... I mean, it was honestly, I was super nervous going in, but once I was talking to the three of them, like it was probably the easiest interview I've ever had in my life. Like, but it was, you know, I was very lucky in the way that they were so easy to talk to, that once I was sort of in the mode of discussion about the game, like I was no longer, you know, I wasn't jittery or anything like that. It was just like very automatic. So, it was a lot of fun, honestly, cool. In retrospect.
After you worked on Netrunner, I think the next big thing is you did Marvel Champions for like ever.
Yeah.
What was that process like? I'm kind of curious, because it's like the Netrunner thing is like, it's a, you guys own the IP in terms of the actual like Android Netrunner universe. And so if you guys want to do something thematically, you could just be like, we're going to do it, because it's like, you know, within reason, but you have a lot more malleability in terms of the universe. But with Marvel Champions, it's like established here. It's like you're like bringing Captain America into the game or whatever, who has like, you know, almost like 5+ decades of comics. Did you find it was harder to like design cards or like develop cards for Marvel Champions, because you'd be like, this is really cool, but like, is this something Captain America would do? Is like, this is really cool, but can we make this something Spider-Man would do? Or did you not find that an issue at all?
On some levels it was harder, but on some levels it was easier. There were definitely points where it was like, you know, oh, we want to do, you know, X or Y thing, but we have to discuss it with licensing or Marvel first. But those instances were honestly really rare. Marvel was extremely hands-off for the most part. There were only a few things that come to mind that they like, you know, would have us revise, but mostly design specifically, like they really were not picky. They didn't control anything. They didn't dictate anything that we did. And in some ways, like the fact that we already had these pre-defined and pre-established characters, like it was, I could go and I could read, you know, one of the comics, or I don't know, I could watch a movie or TV show with Captain America, and I could kind of see the things that he did and the person that he was. And I could model cards off of that. Whereas with like Netrunner or any of the proprietary IPs, sometimes you got to be more imaginative, you got to be more creative, and you have to sort of like, you're creating the world and all these characters within it, and you're sort of defining their personality. So I would say, honestly, in retrospect, it was probably easier a lot of the time to make things for champions instead of for Netrunner, but not 100%. It was probably like an 80-20 type thing.
Perfect. One of the things that I remember happened, like, so I playtested while, like, for the viewers who don't know, I was a playtester while Boggs was the lead designer. I remember I became a playtester because I basically just met him at an FFG regional. And we just chatted, and I was like, hey, can I playtest? He was like, yeah, sure, why not? One of the things I remember happened while I was playtesting is in the lead up to 2018 Worlds, like Magnum Opus, there was one of the responsibilities that I remember you had was you had to design the MWL updates. And
yeah,
the big change was that, you know, for a very long period of time, for many of the FFG card games, there was sort of like house policy was we don't do ban lists. And FFG doesn't do ban lists. And Damon Stone kind of got around this by doing the MWL influence thing, but like it wasn't very effective. And then I remember that you talked. I remember a post where you were like, "I'm gonna go talk to Andrew Navarro about doing a ban list." And then, like 3 days later, you're like, "We're gonna do a ban list." So, what was that discussion like? And was like, I'm so curious about what the dynamics of getting a ban list implemented was.
So generally, yeah, FFG always avoided them. And the idea was that, you know, players spent money in these cards; they should be able to use them in one form or another. But with the Netrunner ban list, it had already been decided by that point that the game was being canceled by whatever time. And Andrew wanted the meta and, you know, kind of the final stretch of the game to be as good as possible. And I just told him, I was like, you know, this is the best way to ensure that. There's a lot of problematic cards in the pool. You know, the card pool was so big at that point. It really wasn't a very long discussion. I think it was actually harder to schedule a meeting with him because he's so busy than it was to convince him to do the ban list. It was maybe a 10-minute conversation. He's like, yeah, okay, do whatever you think is best. And that was it. So, but I know a couple, it's really good that happened, because I know some of the other developers sort of felt more empowered after that. And I don't know which games implemented a ban list and which ones didn't ultimately. But I know that there was a lot more discussion than there had been previously. Before, whenever anyone would bring up a ban list, when I first brought it up in the LCG room, I was told point blank, like, that's not going to happen. Like, it's not even worth taking to upper management, because it's just like, it's never happened. We've pushed for it. It's not going to happen. And then 3 days later, I had it. And everybody was like, oh, okay, maybe we can make that happen. So.
Yeah, I remember, like, years later, Arkham Horror would get like its taboo list, which is sort of like a mixture of the ban list and errata. And I think sometimes about stuff like that, I'm like, I don't think that stuff would have happened if Netrunner hadn't gotten the ban list.
I don't think so either. Yeah,
this is something I'm curious about, because even at 2018 Worlds, there were Nisei staff there who were like doing some early promo for it. I know the policy of FFG, and it makes sense to me, is like basically don't acknowledge Nisei because it's just copyright violation. But what do you think of like Nisei, and like, were people in FFG aware? Was it just like sort of like an open secret? Like, what was the deal with that?
I think it just depended on who you talked to. I think like anyone who already had their nose, you know, to the ground, was already sort of like interacting with the community all the time, like they were aware of Nisei. I knew there was actually a couple people who would like meet every week or every couple weeks during their lunchtime. Some of the employees at Asmodee, and they would play with Nisei's cards, like, you know, once Netrunner was canceled and stuff. There was kind of a group in the company that would do it.
That's so sick. Like,
yeah, but I don't know if it extended beyond them, beyond myself, maybe a few other designers and a couple players who played it. Like, I really couldn't tell you what sort of the understanding of Nisei is, and the, sort of the upper management stuff. Like, I never brought it up to anyone because I think it is one of those things where, like, you know, if it becomes a big deal, then it could become an issue, and nobody wants that to be the case. So it was always sort of like people would just kind of back off, not say anything about it. And in a way, I guess it was sort of an open secret for some people.
I think, yeah, it was one of the things that always struck me was that, like, I don't, it might have still been called the Effigy Center, or like the game center, basically, was really fond of hosting NISA events.
Yeah.
I remember that. They were, like, pretty aggressive. Like, I remember they held a regional in 2019 that I went to, and they were basically like, we love having you guys here. We love Netrunner. Like, please come and do another one next year. And, like, there was a big tournament in July at the Effigy Center. Oh, it's called the Game Center now, with a Z, I think.
Yeah, Game Center with a Z, yeah. Yeah.
That's so fucking funny.
Yep.
I'm gonna ask you to think back to R&R design here, which I know is several years, but Doyle painted this, like, sick-ass pistol shrimp named Senshi, and it was labeled Netrunner, and it's on his art station stuff. Is that a card that was cut from R&R? And if so, can you tell us what it did?
I think I remember that art, because I loved that art.
It's so good.
I could not tell you what it did, though. It was probably a Shaper program. That would be my best guess.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
There was this whole, like, sub-theme in Shaper at that time. I can't remember the details of it, but something with... I forget what's the Pico? Shape.
Akiko.
What's?
It was Big Rig, wasn't it? It was
Akiko. Yeah, it was something with Akiko. Like, her, for some reason, her backstory, there was a sub theme of nautical creatures. I don't remember exactly what tied it together, and I don't think we ever got to explore it because we had to scale so many things back in the box. But anything that related to nautical creatures in that way was probably a Shaper thing, and it was most likely a program.
It's so interesting because the programs in Marine and Reverie are not like aquatic creatures, which I never really understood. Ika. But that makes sense. Ika, but Cuban is also like a whale.
Yeah, it's like a little fish that sticks on the whale.
Water. Yeah, that one's a little fish thing. Yeah. I thought there was one more. Maybe there's not. So what we had to do in some places was when we were making Reign and Reverie, when we started out, so normally most products do two or three waves of art. I think at that point we were doing two waves of art, and each wave was roughly 60 pieces. So, you know, a box is 120 pieces in total. Mm-hmm. For the first 60, I don't even think we did a full wave. I think we only did like maybe 50 something. We did a smaller wave, and more specifically, we only did like the art that would be on the net, like no physical characters, no humans, no physical locations. It was all like things in a computer or programs or, you know, anything related to that. Because at that time, MJ Newman, she needed a lot of characters for Arkham Horror. And most of the character artists were assigned to Arkham Horror for that at that specific time. And so the idea was that we were going to do all of the digital art first. And then in the second wave, once those artists, you know, were no longer working with MJ, they would come in and do all the physical stuff for Netrunner. But then the game got canceled in the middle of that process. Crystal and I were actually having the meeting for that second wave of art to do all the physical characters. So when it came time to like put all the art into the box, that's a sort of what Andrew was saying. Like, I want to, you know, do this box still, but we need to make it without committing too many more resources. So like that second wave was totally canceled, and we just had to sort of salvage different things and scrounge together past pieces that hadn't been used and all this stuff. And so there's actually I think the article that announced Reign and Reverie said something about how it like took place in Shiloh, which was originally supposed to be the case, but that ultimately wasn't the vision I had at the end. I ended up changing the vision document and the whole box to be sort of like a worldwide thing, kind of like the original core set was. It was just sort of like people from all over the world, different places. But somebody at marketing didn't get that memo. And so when they announced it, they're like, it takes place in Chicago. And there's the Statue of Liberty in Chicago. And we were just using all of this art from all these different resources that had just never been used before. And it was, yeah, it's so I think in that whole process, the mantis shrimp definitely got cut, and maybe even Akiko's aquatic theme I think got cut as well. We probably had to swap out some art and stuff to just make it fit better.
It was definitely referenced because it came through, but yeah, obviously you only had so many cards to work with.
Yeah.
Rain and Reverie holds a distinction in the current standard format for Netrunner. It is the set with the least number of cards banned in it. It only has one card banned from it.
Oh, which card?
What card do you think is banned from Rain and Reverie?
Oh man, it's been so long since I'm on Netrunner DB right now. Looking at all the cards in Rain and Reverie, because I genuinely don't remember most of them.
Wait, you mean you don't use Card Game DB? What?
Yeah, holy fuck, I forgot. Yeah, actually at FFG they block Netrunner DB. You have to use Card Game DB. That's how it works.
Give me a hint. What type of card is it?
It's an identity.
Oh, is it Liza?
Yeah, it's Liza.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, she's pretty strong. She's pretty ridiculously powerful.
It turns out drawing two cards for free is pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, so she got banned. It turns out that there was a deck with Mars for Martians and Counter Surveillance. And so you would just take a bunch of tags and you play Mars for Martians and gain money equal to the number of tags you have. And then you use Counter Surveillance to access cards equal to the number of tags you have.
That seemed really good, yeah.
Yeah, that's really... And then
someone on this call won US Nats and almost Canadian Nationals with that.
Yeah, wow. It turns out it's really messed up, especially when you can play Paparazzi and keep it installed with Dummy Box so that you're always immune to meat damage so they can't kill you either.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty powerful. I feel like Green Reverie is one of those sets, though, man. It actually really holds up over time. A lot of these cards are still like
super
played.
It's got such a cachet, yeah.
Oh,
no, game. No, I'm fucking wrong. Game Changer also got banned.
Game Changer. You also got that one banned.
Yeah, Game Changer. The
sports medal. Yeah.
Oh, that's the art with Jason. Oh, yeah, the game. Yeah, that was always... I remember during development, like it was... I think at one point it was... It didn't have a trash cost. It was 5 for its play cost. But yeah, that one took a long time to get to the point where it even felt balanced. But I could see that one there banned.
I remember the original Texas Sports Medal was like the first time you play an operation each turn, discount its cost by the number of agendas in the runner score area.
Yeah, I think I remember that version. Yeah,
and it just was like, oh wow! It turns out playing hedge fund for net 9 is really good.
Pretty good, yeah.
One of the things I like about Rain and Reverie is the flavor is really good. Yeah, it definitely feels more like a world set than a Chilo set. Because I remember like the original, I think we got like 3 versions of like the original cycle. And it was like, because you had interns submit card designs for it.
Yeah, I think I remember
And it was, it was exciting. Because I don't know if those interns really played a lot of Netrunner.
They did not. So actually what happened there was the interns, they were pretty new. We used to have an intern program and new interns would come in every few months. And it was decided that because I was the newest person in the department and because I had been a teacher, I was going to train the interns because training them would teach me how to do the job, which still doesn't really make sense to me, but that was sort of, it really came, so they don't have the intern program anymore, maybe they do now in the last couple months since I haven't been there, but when I left a couple months ago, they didn't have it, and they mostly don't have it anymore because everyone was so busy that, like, the interns would some days just come in and just, like, sit, and they would go to meetings and stuff, but, like, there's only so much you can learn from doing meetings. You really need, like, a hands-on experience, but no one had the time to just rope people in and be like, hey, do this for me. A lot of times it's just easier to do that by yourself.
Yeah. If,
you know, you're going to have to train someone instead. But I was the dummy that, you know, my manager told me, hey, you're going to do this. And I was like, okay, I'll teach them and get them into the game. Oh, they've never played the game before. That's fine. Let's play a few times. And they had an assignment to, like, play the game however many times each week and all this stuff. They never did it. And so the cards that they submitted were more just for their learning experience of design and development, but I never expected the cards to ever go anywhere. I think there was one of the ideas, though. One of the interns told me once that I had, like, he was like, oh, yeah, that's my card. And I was like, okay, yeah, if that makes you feel good, we can say that's your card. That's fine.
I think, yeah, I remember, like, it's so interesting looking at the Chilo set, because I remember one of the, maybe this is in the vision document, I remember there's a discussion about, like, we want to do, like, the sort of spin and Genesis thing of, like, we're going to do, like, another bad pub focus set. And Tag focus set. And because I remember, like, there were, like, all the runner factions cared about giving bad pub, and the corp effects were about sort of bad pub a bit too, because it was supposed to be like, oh, like, you know, this is like a CD city, the original version of Liza before she was called Liza, it was Rebecca, and
yeah, Rebecca Yazzie, yeah,
her whole thing was basically like first time you encountered a piece of ice, each turn you could trash a connection to bypass a piece of ice, and she's just like throwing her allies like under the bus to like get by. It was super flavorful. Have you looked at any of the Nisa cards before?
I have, yeah. When they first started coming out, I followed, you know, Nisa kind of in the background. Over the years, I've followed them less and less. I haven't done it in a while, but there for a bit, I tried to keep on top of it as much as I could.
That makes sense. When you saw the cards for the first time, were you surprised at how... Were you surprised at, like... One of the things that surprised me about Nisa is, for example, that they have decent art. Were you like, oh, like, what was your reaction to the cards? You was like, oh, wow, like, I'm really surprised, or, like, I'm really shocked, or, like, what was your sort of take on it?
Yeah, so when, I think it was at Magnum Opus, it must have been at Magnum Opus, I was talking to a few of the people who were part of Nisei Now, and they were telling me that, you know, they had plans for the future, we're going to do this, and, you know, I wished them the best, but that was the part that I was always afraid of. Like, you can design and develop cards, you can get people to test, like, that part, it's not easy, but I think it's it just demands less resources in a way than, like, actually having new pieces of art created for the game, and that's usually the choke point, even at FFG. I mean, even for Reign and Reverie, that was the choke point, that was the hardest part of the whole process. So yeah, to see some of the art that they get, it's very impressive. Like, I think it's really amazing at how passionate some people are for, you know, the cyberpunk universe and the Netrunner mechanics and all that stuff. The fact that they would create art just sort of on their own and independently, like, that's really awesome.
Yeah, they run tournament, like, they're running a series of online tournaments called the Continental Championships right now, and there's going to be a World Championship in October.
Are you coming?
Am I coming? Oh yeah, I'm gonna go number one.
Nice.
I would love to go to a tournament sometime. I haven't been since Magnum Opus. It would be nice. Maybe one of the future ones I'll try to show up.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like, definitely we can put you in touch with people. There's online stuff, there's, you know, in person stuff. The is still, like, fairly popular, which always surprises me. And more new people keep getting into the game. I just think it's a testament to, like, how strong the base mechanics of that game is. It's just, like, no matter kind of the card pool, it's just, like, a really timeless and compelling set of mechanics.
Yeah, the Nisei starter set is pretty solid at teaching the game as well.
Yeah, that's true. They did a system gateway, which is, like, a specific, like, a... It's like sort of like a dual deck focused teaching set.
Yeah. I've read through some of those cards specifically, and then also some of the way they wrote the rules and stuff. They did a really, really good job.
Yeah. As a designer, when you, or like developer, when you work on cards and you see them actually played in the wild, are you like, do you ever, like, even maybe as Marvel Champions, do you ever have moments where you're like, oh, I didn't fucking intend that? Or is it just sort of like, you just, like, let it go, and, like, whatever happens, happens, and you sort it out later.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you definitely... there have been so many moments where you create a card and you think it's going to work one way or be used in a specific way, and people find ways to break it. But I'm of the opinion that that's kind of the point of card games. Like, to me, that's fun. That's what I always want to do as a player, is find new uses and, you know, be creative with the cards that I have. And as long as it's not breaking the game or making it unfun for the other people, then, like, from a design perspective, I think that's really good. I think it gets people invested. They feel really connected to these, you know, little things that they've figured out or cool interactions that they can do.
I remember very vividly there's this Wayland asset from Katara, I think Katara, called Reconstruction Contract, and it's a 1/4. It's a 1-res 4-trash asset that just says the first time each turn, like the runner takes damage, you put an advancement counter on it, and then you can trash the asset to like move all the advancement counters to another installed card. So it's like, oh, they take damage, and then like you get these counters, and you can use them to score an agenda, right?
I remember that one, yeah.
Yeah, and then there's another card called Dedication Ceremony. It's a 1-cost operation that just says put 3 advancement tokens on a resed card. And I remember the discussion at the time was like, oh, like I remember like one of my people in my pod in testing was basically like, hey, like just so you know, maybe you should make Reconstruction Contracts say power counters, because you could use that, in theory, you could use Dedication Ceremony to score like a 2-3 agenda from hand. Like, that's pretty good. And I think like you and like all the testers were like, that's not good. It's like a 3-card combo. Like, who would play that? And then it turned out that like Rococo Dedication Ceremony combo was like a really strong deck for the next 3 years, which is like really cool. Like, it's like one of those things you don't expect, and it turns out to be really good.
I'm looking. Oh, okay. Yeah. I remember that. I actually don't remember that combo right now, but I can see how it is powerful. Yeah, it's definitely. I mean, you do got to draw into 2 cards, so. Did it break the game? Like, was it too strong? Was the deck too strong?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, it's counterplay. You can trash one of them, you know.
That's good. Yeah. In my opinion, as long as, like, there's, like, I think it's cool when you can kind of look, like, you get a card and you're like, oh, this is neat, but I'm going to use it in a totally different way than it's intended. Like, yeah, I think that actually sounds really, that sounds interesting. I don't even know if I knew that was a deck, to be honest. I actually forgot about that. I remember designing that card. I don't remember what it did before. There were a lot of cards, like I would say probably 80% of the cards changed pretty dramatically in Katara. Like Damon had like set up all 120 cards before I came in, but I think him and I had like, you know, and as any designer will, we had very different visions for what the card pool should be and what it should focus on. And like I remember going through, because we already had all of the art was already commissioned. So like whatever I created had to be within the confines of the art that was made. Mm. And I remember like going through a couple different iterations for this one, or thinking about a couple different iterations of this one. I'm glad the card was used. It's always kind of sucks when you go through all these iterations and then people are just like, that card sucks. I'm never going to touch it.
Okay. Yeah, the funny thing about Reconstruction Contact is it's like almost. Like, I mean, I don't think this is a bad thing. It's like basically never played for its intended use case.
Like, sure, yeah.
It just turns out that the combo with Dedication Ceremony is so powerful that like you spend like 9 influence importing 3 Dedication Ceremonies into HB, and you 4 influence on one of these, and you like build a combo deck out of that, and like you tutor for the pieces because it's just like good enough.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, it's really cool. I feel like that happens. Like, I mean, I've been doing like a bunch of like I've play tested for all of the Nisei cycles, and like some of the cards change like dramatically and stuff, you know. But yeah, no, it's cool. I actually got to design a card recently for winning a tournament, and it's like now out in the published world, and that's a really exciting experience.
Oh, that's cool. Which card is it?
That's Mutually Assured Destruction.
Oh, that's awesome. Mutually.
It's quite the card.
Destruction 4. Oh, it's 4-cost. Google said Mutually Assured Destruction 4. I was like, wow. It's the sequel to all the other 3.
That would be awesome.
Oh, that's cool. I really like that. That's awesome.
Yeah. So the idea is it's like a combo. It's like a win condition for acid spam decks.
That's awesome.
Because it's like one of the problems I think with acid spam is just like the games go really long. And just so having them a way to be like, oh, like you can actually turn these assets into a way to win the game. It's nice.
Yeah.
But it's cool. Like Nisei still does the champion cards. They do a lot of community stuff now, and they actually just released the set Midnight Sun about a month ago.
I remember hearing about that one. I don't think I've had the opportunity much to look through the card pool, but yeah, I do. Sure. I saw some articles and stuff pop up. Some people had shared it on Facebook or something like that.
It's a bit funny because they reuse that Shaper nautical theme that you started in R&R.
Oh, neat. That's cool.
Can I bug you? Can I ask some questions about Marvel Champions?
Yeah, sure.
So when they were like, we're going to do Marvel Champions, did they come to you and were like, hey, we want to do a Marvel game, figure it out? Were you like, hey, I want to do this co-op game? And then they were like, what was the sort of like genesis of that idea? Like, whose idea was it? Like, or did you just, like, one day did they just, like, plop a bunch of, like, documents on your desk and you're like, okay, you're doing a co-op Marvel deck builder, you know, get on it. Like, what was that process like?
So, yeah, Netrunner was canceled. I was sort of in this weird in-between state for a little bit of time where I was still sort of the caretaker for Netrunner, but I wasn't actively developing any new content for it. At the same time, I was on Star Wars Destiny, and I was helping with that, but I was also on Star Wars Destiny with Lucas Litzinger and Jeremy Zwirn, who are two of the best designers that I know. So it's not like Jeremy, they needed a lot of help.
Jeremy's insane.
Yeah, Jeremy, he's an amazing, amazing designer, amazing developer. And Star Wars Destiny, I liked the game enough, but like I didn't play it that regularly. And I also, when I first started at FFG, I kind of helped out from the beginning, but it was always like in the background, always helping with art and stuff like that. So it wasn't like I could do a lot with the design. So it was always sort of like the whole time I helped with Destiny. It was always in the background to help with art stuff. And that takes some time. Sometimes it can be very time consuming, but it's at different points in the development process. You can't really make a full-time job out of just writing art briefs. Like some companies do have you do that, but usually you're doing it for multiple products or multiple waves of stuff at a time. But with the way Destiny developed stuff, at least back then, it just like would be every month or two, I might have like a big wave. And then, you know, between waves, it was just sort of a lot of downtime. So I was kind of bounced around. I was put on Keyforge to help a little bit. They talked about having me help on Arkham. Eventually it was decided that we were going to do a new card game. And I know they talked about different themes, potentially doing Android again, maybe do it in like the Terranoth setting. But there was, I don't know how they came about it or how it was decided, but they got like the Marvel license. And as soon as they did, they were like, oh yeah, we're definitely doing a card game in the Marvel license. Like that'll basically just, you know, print money. Right. So,
that makes sense to me.
Yeah. And so like, it was going to be myself and Nate French, just the two of us on it. Nate French is really good too.
Nate French is cracked.
He is, yeah. And he's been on pretty much, aside from Netrunner and Destiny, like those are the only two card games at FFG that he hadn't worked on. Everything else, L5R and Arkham and Keyforge and all the other ones.
Call of Cthulhu too, right?
Call of Cthulhu, like, yeah, so many of them. He was the lead or he did major parts of the development. So this was right before he was set to move into the lead developer role of the studio. So it was going to be his last big project. And as we were starting the project up, all the developers in the LCG department heard about it. And Caleb Grace, who was working on Lord of the Rings at the time, came forward and was like, I am a massive Marvel nerd. Like, I've collected the comics since I was a kid. Like, I know everything there is to know about Marvel. Like, put me on this game. I want to be on this game. And so they did. And so it ended up being myself and Caleb and Nate. And I mean, that's kind of that. They just got the license and then told the three of us to make a Marvel game. And then at some point it was like, we were deciding, are we going to do a cooperative game? Are we going to do a competitive game? And then something with the license, I don't know the specifics of it, but they told us like, you have to make a cooperative game. We're like, well, okay, well that settles that debate. And then everything else just kind of is history from there.
One of the things that strikes me as so interesting about that game, and it's so interesting because I didn't know that thing about Caleb. One of the things that is really interesting to me is that Arkham Horror was already a thing when Marvel Champions was being designed. And Arkham Horror, my impression is that Arkham Horror is one of the more popular product lines that Fantasy Flight produces.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it also has the campaign mode, which is unlike Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings is like, it has like a bit of a campaign, but like not like upgrading your decks or anything. It has it's pretty much like all self-contained scenario play. And that's pretty much true of Marvel Champions. I think they did some campaign expansions later where it's like the scenarios are linked together. What was the sort of decision-making being like, we're not going to do a campaign, we are going to do a campaign? Like, how did you guys decide we're going to make this different from Arkham Horror or Lord of the Rings? Or are you just like, we're going to steal the best parts of Lord of the Rings, the best parts of Arkham Horror? Like, what was the thought process behind that?
It was actually, so the game was pitched as sort of being just standalone, like Lord of the Rings. It almost like I think the conversation, I don't know if this was ever like an official conversation, not one that we ever had with higher ups, but the conversation that was had between myself and Nate and Caleb at least once or twice was almost like an arcade style game where you sit down, you play a level, you fight the villain, and then you're done. And that was how we developed the core set. And after the core set with the Green Goblin scenario pack and the Wrecking Crew scenario pack and all the heroes and stuff, it was always intended to sort of be this like standalone thing. And that was the case up until we started developing the first major expansion, the Rise of Red Skull box. And we were deep in development. Caleb was the primary designer on that. He was the lead developer on that specific product. But I would say the product was probably roughly around 70 to 80% finished. And we were getting to the end. And I think it was Andrew Navarro, like, kind of saw everything. And he was like, I want this to be a campaign. This needs campaign elements. You need some sort of thing that ties it together more than just, you know, a loose story. It needs to have some sort of mechanical ties. So I remember that Caleb was very much against it at first. Not against it, but Caleb's concern at first was how much development time a campaign takes. Like any sort of thing that you're adding to a box, you know, it's going to take time away from something else. And Caleb, I think it was more with his experience for Lord of the Rings. Like I think some people definitely play the campaigns in Lord of the Rings, but from what Caleb has said, like there's also a huge subset of players that just play them standalones, don't play them linked together. And I think for Caleb, like he wanted more time to focus on making each individual scenario or each hero that comes with the box even better than they would be. But, you know, ultimately we had to make time for the campaign elements, and campaigns do take a lot of time, but they're also the thing that is like, in a way, the least important, like having these scenarios function to be fun, having the scenarios function to be fun. Like those are the top priorities. And the campaign is always sort of at the end of all that process. You need to get all the major parts working for each individual thing before you can even make them all fit together and, you know, have interconnecting parts. So, I actually think Caleb's original direction was probably better for the game overall, just because I've seen a lot of complaints for the Marvel Champions campaigns. Not a lot of players like them. And I think they don't like them because they're expecting something deeper and more interesting like Arkham Horror, but the game was never built with that in mind.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was always sort of my, I was really interested because like I've played a bit of Marvel Champions and it always seemed to me that the campaign thing was a bit of an afterthought. Maybe like afterthought's a bit of a rude way to say it, but like it definitely wasn't intended. and it's interesting to sort of hear that backstory.
Yeah, it was a secondary thing for sure.
Had that ever come up in your Netrunner design? Because there was the Terminal Directive campaign, which, you know, had a handful of problems in itself, but is that something that had come up and thought, hey, we should give this another shot?
For Netrunner, I don't remember any discussion about that. Terminal Directive, I think, had only been out a very brief amount of time when I started. So,
yeah.
Like, I if the game had lasted, I could definitely see them wanting to do something like that again in the future. Maybe it could have been put in an even bigger box. But I don't know. Yeah, yeah. Maybe double the size. If you can fit yourself in the box, that's really the goal.
I still use the box. So, you know, value.
Yeah, I mean, you can literally... Yeah, you can put anything in there. It's a huge box. But I think if the game continued on, they probably would have wanted to do something like it. But at the time, no one ever mentioned it that I remember.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it was really good having you on, Boggs. I really appreciate.
Yeah, this was amazing.
Oh yeah. Yeah, thank you guys. It was fun talking to you.
Yeah, for sure. If you ever want any sort of like info or stuff about Nisa, hit me up. Like we'll keep you in the loop. If
you came to like Google, come on.
Okay, if you ever came to like a big tournament of world championship, people would lose their shit. Like you'd get, I'd get fucking shit signed by you, absolutely. So
I was losing my shit the whole time in the background. That's why I was so quiet.
You're remembered very fondly in the network community, I guess.
Absolutely,
that's awesome. I'll definitely come to something sometime. I just gotta, you know, figure out which country I'll be in at that time, buy all the plane tickets, all that stuff.
Fair. So. You got any current projects you want to plug?
Nothing that I can plug currently. I am working on some stuff. It'll be a while before I can show it off, but
Netrunner 3.
Ooh.
Yeah, Netrunner 3. There you go. No, I'm there's some stuff that I'm excited about, and I think people enjoy, but it'll be a little bit.
Perfect. Okay. Well, thanks so much for coming on, man. Have a great night.
Yeah. Thank you, guys. Have a good one.
Dude, we got the Netrunner cancellation story. That's like the holy grail.
That is the actual holy grail. I know he's saying it. It's like, holy shit, people have been asking about this for years.
Holy fuck. Yeah, when he was on that show, I was like, I can't believe I'm sitting here listening to this man tell us how Netrunner was canceled.
The only thing he forgot to tell us is where he buried the Keyforge algo, but you know.
Okay, I'll see you then, Phil.
Have a good one. Hello?
Hello. Is this the ShadowNet?
This is the ShadowNet. Is this Morgan?
It is. Ah, Phil. Ah, it's great to hear you. It's been a while.
Thanks for calling in. Yeah, that's too bad. You just missed our bonus guest, Michael Boggs.
Oh, wow. Oh, fantastic. Oh, I'll definitely have to make sure I listen in to what happened before I
join. Yeah. Oh, it's been so long you've been on. I'm glad you could call in. You know, I actually had a question for you. You know it's Continentals right now. As is tradition, Canada won APAC.
Yes, that does seem to be the tradition now.
But after that, we have a different event coming up.
But we have the Netrunner World Championships, which I'm actually going to be at in person.
Oh, very exciting. Well, I'm looking forward to see you there.
Oh, excellent. If you're going to be there, that's great news. I'm looking forward to seeing you there as well.
Absolutely. Well, I just have a quick question then for you. Who or what will win Worlds?
That is a question.